Hello there, and you're very welcome to the Politics Podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. Joining me in studio today were our political reporter, Sarah Barden, and our deputy political editor, Fia Kelly. Among the subjects under discussion were prudent Pascal Donoghue, Leo Varadkar's public image, what's going on in Sinn Féin after their emergency Ardèche, and gender balance in political debate in Ireland. You may hear a few disagreements along the way. Fia, I'm looking at your Inside Politics Digest this morning. It's all about prudent Pascal. The summer budget statement came out this week. It's usually a pretty underwhelming occasion anyway. It seems particularly underwhelming this year.
Yeah, it's kind of a what initially was intended to be a couple of years ago when Fine Gael and Labour in office, they almost, we can't believe it's not really a budget, but it was initially intended to be almost half a budget where you'd have some sort of policy announcements. The intention never turned out to be the case.
Yeah, I think this newspaper foolishly cleared a couple of pages to fill it with lots of interesting detail, which didn't actually materialise. Yeah.
And then what it has become is a very dry economic document in which they outline what they believe as of now they have to spend in the budget in October. So it's kind of done by necessity because you have to tell the European Commission in the springtime anyway what you believe your parameters are. So what initially started out as a spring statement is now the summer statement. So what Pascal Donoghue did yesterday, he said, look, I believe I have 3.4 billion of money to spend in this budget in October, the so-called fiscal space, although he says he's moving away from that concept. But he says, actually it's not quite correct, I'll correct myself in a second, but he says that he has already committed 2.6 billion of that between public sector pay, demographic costs, capital commitments in the Project Ireland 2040 plan. So he's saying he only has 800 million of new money to play around with on budget day. Now, the rub in this is that he says that he could spend an extra 900 million on top of that, but would push us further into deficit, and he does not want to do that. You may remember like our whole leprechaun economics and how multinationals play with our economic figures. That so those kind of off-kilter figures feed into the European Commission's calculations, and by those figures we would actually have what is the 4.3 billion, strictly speaking, fiscal space to spend. Because our figures are off kilter.
I have to be honest, my eyes are starting to glaze over a bit about all these numbers. No, but I mean, this is one of the problems with these discussions, because this is bloody important stuff. But the point is, I suppose, that in the same way as during the Celtic Tiger years, the government, Charlie McCreevy and Brian Cowan after him, you know, there was boom time cash coming through the doors, and it went straight out the door again on tax cuts and expenditure and public sector pay rises and all that stuff. And then when the tap dried up, it was a complete disaster.
Yeah, so what Pascal Donoghue is saying is basically, I'm not going to spend all the money that's available to me. By my calculations, I think I have 800 million new money to play around on budget day. That's, again, splitting a 2-to-1 ratio, as we know, between spending increases and tax cuts. Although I would be highly likely that he will raise taxes elsewhere to fund income tax cuts and dealing with the income tax bans, as he did last year.
So it'd be tax neutral?
I would, not necessarily, but he'll have to raise some taxation to pay for tax cuts and spending increases. So that's the kind of dry economics of it and the boring economics of it. But politically, what he's been trying to do for a number of months is to, we all come into this conference supply deal thinking the first two budgets are going to be tight, the third is going to be bonanza, you know, shotguns in the air, party time is back again. What they've done gradually is to try and change that perception to say, oh, hang on, we don't have that much money, you know, we already committed this, we already committed that, we pull it back a bit. So politically, they've obviously decided that prudence is the best policy now, and that the public do not want before an election the typical old style pre-election budgets of 3 and 4 billion euro. So politically, what he's also tried to do is almost box Fianna Fáil in. So he's saying, this is what I have decided, me, Pascal Donoghue, not the European Commission, is the appropriate level of money to be spent. And if you disagree with me, you're going to increase the deficit. He has, to a certain extent, been successful in that, because the Fianna Fáil statement yesterday basically accepted his figures. A couple of months ago, they saw what he was up to and believed that he was setting a political trap for them. And they clearly, I think, had a think between themselves, said, okay, what way do you approach this? The best way to approach this is to be responsible. And if you notice, the statement from Michael McGrath, Barry Cowan yesterday, spoke about the stability we offered the country in conference supply. That's exactly what Micheál Martin said at the weekend. So they've clearly hit in this message that this is the stability we are providing the country. And if they're to follow through on that argument, they have to do the third budget. And I think they've already reconciled themselves to the fact that it is not going to be a massive budget and they're going to see it through.
Do you agree with that, Sarah? And does that put Fianna Fáil in a rather uncomfortable box, not to mention one that they, historically, the party isn't used to being in? It should be going full bore opposition to all this and be looking for, give the money back to the people.
The way I see the summer economic statement is like signing your Pioneer pledge and then 6 months later, you know, having a nagging of vodka in the field with your friends, or promising your parents when you have a, or your neighbours or your partner when you're having a house party. It'll be really quiet. It's just a couple of friends over and then they wake up to the gaff being absolutely wrecked the next morning. Anyone who thinks that this budget will not provide some goodies for people just doesn't understand politics. The reality is, whether we have an election in November, January or July, this is the election that Fine Gael will go to the country, as will Fianna Fáil. And anyone who thinks that there won't be additional measures for middle income earners, as was indicated yesterday by Pascal Donoghue, or more money for pensioners, just, you know, it just doesn't stand up to scrutiny. Like, you know, Pascal is Prudent Pascal, as Fiac put in his digest this morning. He's a very shrewd political operator. But he's also, you know, he's also a politician. And he knows that if he's going to a general election, it may be this year, it may be early next year, he's not going to go to it on a budget that doesn't give something back to everybody in the audience.
So is most of this spin? Is that what you're saying? I mean, he's saying that he's putting out this posture and this appearance, but the reality is it's going to be business as usual.
What I think he tried to do was to dismantle the expectation that it was going to be a massive 3.4 billion euro budget. Sarah's right. The last two budgets we've had have been around the 1 to 1.5 billion mark, and that has been, you know, you got a fiver in your pension, you got a fiver in your child benefit, you got a bit of income cuts in your USC, you got thresholds at which you hit the higher rate of income tax raised. But so I think what we're seeing is him trying to bring this budget back in line with those budgets. So there's still going to be goodies to go around, which is not of the level that we all thought it was going to be 3 years ago. It's not going to be a 3.44 billion budget.
Yeah, but there are two parts to this. One is, what's the best thing for the current Minister for Justice to do for the economy? And there are a lot of economists making approving noises, including our own, you know, Cliff Taylor in today's newspaper. You know, all this thing of being pro-cyclical and anti-cyclical and don't be, you know, blowing loads of money when the economy is at risk of overheating anyway. And the other one is the political calculation that, you know, that you're talking about. Irish governments have never quite managed to square those, have they? Are you saying it's still going to happen again?
I think, you know,
I mean, we shouldn't be borrowing money, should we?
Fianna Fáil actually agree with that. They say, like, privately, they're saying, look, we can't really be borrowing now again. If we're not going to do it now, when are we going to do it? When are we going to fix this budgetary problem? So there seems to be a broad agreement between the two parties that this 800 million figure thereabouts is what you get to whilst maintaining that trajectory. But the question is going to be, do we follow the pattern of last year by raising other taxation measures to pay for, but the budget package, as Sarah says, for your fiver, for your increase, your cuts in income tax. And Pascal Donoghue and Michael McGrath kind of took off the low-hanging fruit last year with the stamp duty and commercial properties. That was just waiting to be done. More problematic issues may arise this year. Like, for example, pre-election budget, do you raise diesel? Diesel is basically, as someone in government said to me, yeah, we may say we're not going to raise it for the purposes of hauliers and Brexit, but it's actually a tax on the middle classes. Families who drive around the suburbs with their kids in the back of the car, we're not going to do that before an election. Do you increase the 9% VAT rate for the hospitality sector that's been kind of talked about for a number of years? These are the tough choices they're going to have to make this year if they are going to give that budgetary package of whatever, 1 billion plus. The kind of easy options are gone now. Like, sugar tax is going to raise you how much? 50 million, 60 million. You need a couple of big ticket items in there, and they're going to have to rummage around for those.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm too high-minded, Sarah, but I mean, I look at Pascal Donoghue and he seems to, you know, I mean, I read what he writes. He writes sometimes for the Irish Times. He writes quite interestingly about politics. And I kind of think there's a bit of substance there. And of course, you're absolutely right. He's a politician, and item one on the agenda is to get elected. But maybe item two and item three bespeak some kind of a set of ideological principles about the best way to run the country over the next few years.
Yeah, I think
am I just being too high-minded?
No, I think you've a fair point, but I also think, you know, we can't ignore the realities of the situation Pascal Donoghue finds himself in, where he has a leader who wants to go to a general election in the not-so-distant future on this budget, who wants a bit of goodies to go around. But he also has an opposition party whose support he relies upon for the budget to pass. He also has an independent alliance who will throw their toys out of the pram ahead of budget day on whatever issue they see fit to do so on this particular occasion. So I think, you know, if we came back and after another general election and Pascal Donoghue was still Minister for Finance, I think we'd really see, you know, the mettle in Pascal Donoghue at that occasion. I think it's really difficult for him to do anything concrete or solid. And Fiacca is saying there, you know, you have to make the tough decisions this year. In reality, those decisions that need to be made won't be made in this year's budget, because they don't have the luxury of making them, because, you know, we're in general election territory.
Well, I kind of understand that in relation to things like the diesel tax, which, mm-hmm. which Fiacca was talking about. But still, you know, I think, as you know, reading, you know, Harry McGee's digest yesterday about Pascal Donoghue, and I was wondering, I often hear from people in your trade, listening, and I'm listening a bit from outside, that Pascal Donoghue is has a very kind of a positive public kind of profile. He's seen as very amiable and outgoing, open. And then people say, but he's actually quite conservative. Does that mean ideologically conservative or as averse to risk taking?
Well, I would say averse to risk taking. Like, he does see Ireland as a Northern European country, in line with the kind of German way of doing things, the Dutch way of doing things. That's what he sees Ireland as, this new Hanseatic League he's talked about. So that's very much where his point of view is coming from. And I do think that he's so much bet the house now on being prudent, that if he doesn't adhere to this budgetary policy this year and he just opens the floodgates in September, he will have done irreparable damage to his own political standing. And as far as I know, there was a healthy debate within government around the start of this year, January, February, March, about what way do we approach this budget? Do we want to spend? Do we want to restrict the spending? And he was very much of the view that no, we need to pull some back, we need to hold some back. And it took some convincing of the Taoiseach to get him around to that point of view. Now, is that argument settled? As Sarah says, that's all well and good in the summer, but when you get to September and the pressure is on, that might change. But even the Taoiseach's statement the other day at the doorstep about, we're not going to risk everything, we're not going to do anything. They seem to be of a mind now that they've decided this is the best course.
And to what extent, if at all, was the way that argument played out influenced by the way in which the last election played out, when you had an awful lot of talk going on in the run-up to it about the government was waiting and it was going to have a budget that actually finally had a couple of goodies, to use your own word, for the electorate, and they would get those out, and then you had to wait a couple of months for those goodies to take effect on the electorate, and none of that worked. They had a terrible election, the two
government
parties.
Well, they talked about the keep the recovery going at the last general election, and they were rudely reminded that not everyone had felt the recovery. So do you want to go into another general election telling everybody you have X, Y and Z to spend, and if you vote for us we'll give you A, B and C? Do you know what I mean? And I don't think that's a risk that they will take. But also, people have in the back of their mind the issue of Brexit, and I think most polls would suggest that people are acutely aware of the consequences that Brexit may bring for Ireland. And I think, I don't think, if that's your argument going into a budget, what political party could argue against that?
Well, you could make the argument, and I have no doubt that some of the independents and the parties of the left will make the argument that we have a housing crisis of the worst sort whatsoever, and the state should be spending more money to fix that faster.
The intriguing thing about yesterday as well was that Fianna Fáil, her saying this has to be a housing budget. If there's one issue this has to tackle, well, housing and health, but they seem to be veering more towards housing now. And Pascal Donoghue said, well, hang on, we already have committed 1.5 billion in capital expenditure, and that's in Project Ireland 2040, and a lot of that's gone on housing. And the question then arises, yeah, but you've decided that. Usually the budget is decided in consultation with Fianna Fáil. They sit down over a couple of weeks and trash out what the budget should contain. So what he seemed to say was, well, we've already decided a lot of the capital expenditure measures in housing. Fianna Fáil want to come with different proposals, that's fine. So on another level there, again, it's incredibly difficult for Fianna Fáil to come in. They have to prize open Project Ireland 2040 again. And I think their demands may be slightly different now. It might be, more focused on affordable housing, getting, tweaking to make sure that supply comes on board. So there's a various different political kind of traps in this and webs within this that it's going to make the budgetary negotiations very tricky. And I think that it feeds into an election message of the economy is going well, the country is going well. Yes, there are problems in health and housing, but we fixed it and we are now managing it responsibly. I think that's the key message. Don't ruin it. And I think, if they get Fianna Fáil to buy into that, they can say, look, we've even made a convert to Fianna Fáil.
The difficulty, though, is about putting the money in the rainy day fund, €500 million in the rainy day fund, where people would argue whether or not that should go towards housing. We've an immediate housing crisis. But then, in a year's time, if there is a property crash, which all indicators would suggest there may be one, will Pascal Donoghue you know, be the wise man when he has 500 million in a in a rainy day fund in which he can rely upon when things go belly up.
We should, like, we are talking very much about Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil here. We should also remember that they're not just the only two parties in the Dáil. Obviously, they are the ones that formulate the budget, but the Labour Party has taken that position that, that Sarah has said. They are accusing Pascal Dunne of basically pulling a political stroke here by holding some money back, and they say, look, there's far more there to spend than you're letting on. They don't subscribe to the idea of a rainy day fund. They say this is a rainy day when you have issues of health and housing to solve. But Fianna Fáil's, the rainy day fund was their idea. They're bought into it. The government are bought into it. And, you know, it'd be very difficult to break that apart now.
And to what extent does that political dance work there now then, that Micheál Martin has put Barry Cowan, who's a more pugnacious kind of a, you know, a figure dealing with some of these issues on the floor?
That was the fear. Like, I remember the day the Fianna Fáil reshuffle, I was on holidays actually, and I got a text from someone in government going, that's it, they're going to blow up the budget because they put Barry Cowan in public expenditure. I don't think that's the case. Like, Micheál Martin last week, I was speaking to him myself, and he said he is now flagging the October Council as the next big milestone that needs to provide stability. So that, to me, said we're signed on all the way till October now.
And so therefore that effectively is going to get you through the budget.
Yes, and the arguments he was saying, and Michael McGrath said it today again in Morning Ireland, they said it in the Dorset, they've obviously sat down and said, our argument is we provide the country with stability. This is to counter Leo Varadkar saying, well, they're going to cause an election by, you know, not renewing the deal. They say we provided stability. And in order to do that, you have to be signed up to the budget. And all the vibes I'm getting so far is that they are going to do it. And they've always wanted to do it, but they've reconciled themselves with this kind of budgetary jiggery-pokery.
Well, I think Fiacc's right. I think, you know, Micheál has been quite clear. I think that I genuinely believe this budget will pass. Everything is to play for after that. But there was two reasons that Barry Cowan was put into that portfolio. Number one is because he's a little bit more of a grassroots favourite than perhaps Michael McGrath would be. Understands the mood of Fianna Fáil. You know, his family is inbred in the party. But the second reason, which nobody really probably realised at the time, was Barry Cowan's put there to watch Michael McGrath. You know,
explain that to me.
A couple of months ago, you know, prior to the abortion referendum, it looked like Micheál Martin was in a bit of bother, you know. 34 of his TDs were standing in a photograph opposing a policy that he was canvassing for. And the only alternative at that stage seemed to be to Micheál Martin as leader was Michael McGrath. He had the support of the majority of the parliamentary party on his stance on abortion. He's a very fine political operator. He's really articulate when it comes to media. So Micheál Martin's, you know, he's quite wise, and he knew, you know, Michael McGrath could potentially go on a solo run if left there unobserved. And I would see it that Micheál Martin made the decision to put Barry Cowan in there to keep a very close
exactly
eye.
Exactly the kind
on
of insight
McGrath.
That insight that our listeners like to come to this podcast.
Let's go in wheels within wheels again, and let's forget, like, the Cowans don't forget either. The Cowans remember who took Brian Cowan out all those years ago. So
absolutely.
So, an election in February then?
It would seem to be going in that direction now, because there is this kind of dance that, you know, the October Council is now there, Micheál Martin, so that's really important. The budget is now looking like it's going to be agreed.
A month before Britain.
But then, you know,
okay,
if he says that October 2018 is so important, then why not March 2019? When Brexit actually takes effect, and there is talk this week I saw of even a special council meeting in December or November. This could go on and on. So the question I think will be is, when does Leo Varadkar formally approach him to extend the deal? He said he wants to do it before the budget. So when does he do that? Does he do it in September? And what does Micheál Martin say? You know, Micheál Martin said it's a matter for after the budget. So, you know, that's the next question really. When does he approach him? Probably around, let's say, after September. He'll get told no. Well, this is the review, is the end of 2018, and then what does Micheál Martin do when he then approaches him a second time and says it's time to talk?
Well, Micheál seems to think that it's not going to happen until the end of the year, so there does already seem to be a conflict as to whether the negotiations will begin. But I'm a bit of a cynic. I think, you know, this delay in introducing the abortion legislation has all got a part to play in when the timing of the next general election will be. Because if it was introduced in July, it could potentially be passed in October. Okay, so you go to the country with the abortion issue, you know, off the agenda. This is what the people voted for. This is what the House of the Oireachtas have now legislated for. if you give it that extra bit of, I suppose, space and time, and it's not passed until the end of the year, we go to the country in February, abortion won't be a general election issue. If we go to the country prior to the passing of abortion legislation, it will absolutely be an issue. But also the second thing is that Leo and Fine Gael are very much going up in the polls. You know, there's no question or doubt about that. But he's also mindful that there's something that may potentially, you know, he hasn't had a very difficult time as leader. Really, the biggest controversy has been the cervical check issue. People have supported the government's position on
the
Brexit.
He had the Fitzgerald issue, which was a bit of a wobble.
Yeah, but it didn't reflect anywhere in the polls. People actually,
there is a view among some of the front pages of Fianna Fáil that he's doing so well. The best we can do is sit and wait for the halo to fall off him, and you know, let's just sit it out. And why not do another year if we have to?
And speaking of that, Leo as a product, how's that being developed or managed? We were hearing a couple of leaks over the course of the last few days about what the approach is to the presentation of Leo Varadkar.
Yeah, Sunday Independent had a story about Fine Gael road testing slogans about, you know, let Leo lead on. Prudence, not promises, was one that hardly would get the juices flowing. I can't remember the rest of them.
They all sound terrible.
Yeah, but there is, what it is there's...
Let Leo lead on is really, really terrible.
I think that was kind of tongue-in-cheek.
The one that won, as far as I know, Fiacc, is it was Leo's team. Let Leo's team lead or something. I think that's the one they've actually chosen. If you look at their social media account, they have all these, Fine Gael's social media account, they have all these photographs of Leo standing with Simon Harris, Pascal Donoghue, and...
You'd want to stay away from the gin and tonics if you were going to have to be shouting that out, that slogan from the rooftops, all right.
Yeah. But what there is a group within the party, at the top of the party, that is doing all this stuff, and it's been very much working away in the background since Christmas. And it's with a view to being ready if he wants to call it, when he wants to call it, that they got caught at Christmas and are not going to get caught again.
And in terms of the day-to-day management of the Taoiseach, that's a bit different from his predecessor, for example, is he? I mean, I know you guys in the political core are a little peeved sometimes that he doesn't do the sort of doorstep accessibility.
Well, Bertie used to do three a day. Someone's to remind me the other day, which is a bit much, but he kind of set this bar. And then there's a tradition that the Taoiseach is accessible to the press to answer questions on the issue today a couple of times a week, not every day, you know, a couple of times a week. But there is.
Is that a tradition back to Bertie or back further than that?
I think it goes back to Bertie mostly. I'd have to ask some of my esteemed colleagues about whether John Bruton did it or not. But I think it was a kind of an arrangement arrived at because people said, look, we can just approach in the street and ask you questions if you like. Like, if you want to operate that way, we'll do it. And they said, okay, no, there's a different way of doing things. We'll do what kind of media haggles or whatever. And I think in keeping with Varadkar taking over, a lot of talk last year when he took over was about how he was going to adopt a more, you know, not presidential, but more distant style of leadership, kind of the Macron Jupiterian model, you know, not accessible to the media as much. You know, the parliamentary party would say, and I even noticed myself, he turned up to a commemoration in Dean's Grand Cemetery on Sunday with two cars, so two big shiny Beamers. It's this kind of projection of the office, and I think that's what we're seeing. They're trying to bring him back into this. We're not that accessible all the time, and it's causing a bit of trouble on our front because we feel he's not as accessible or answerable to us as much.
Yeah, the former Taoiseach Enda Kenny had a rule that he wouldn't do doorstep with media on a Tuesday, Wednesday, and Tuesday and Wednesday because he would answer questions in the Dáil. And, you know, most media accept that, but he would do a doorstep on most other occasions. Where Leo comes into a bit of difficulty is that he was more than accessible to the media at every single event that he attended as Minister for Social Protection, as Minister for Transport, and Minister for Health for that matter too. He was available to us and willing to answer our questions in a very forthright and honest way. It's probably got him to the position that he is because even as he says in his Twitter profile is, you know, he was a man that was known to talk too much. You know, and suddenly he becomes Taoiseach and he starts to enforce that.
Why do you think he's done that? Is it about crafting a certain perception of it? Or is it that he's not actually terribly good at these?
He has a rule, though, which I think is actually important in this conversation, is that if there is a controversy in health, if there's a controversy in justice, if there's a controversy, his rule is that the minister in that portfolio has to be the one answering questions before he has to answer the questions on particular subjects.
Okay, so there's a certain logic to that.
There is, but also in people, whilst, let's say, for example, in the cervical check controversy, you know, Simon Harris was out almost every single day on the subject matter. And Leo Varadkar didn't answer questions on the subject, only in the Dáil. And when he then did the statement as to when the announcement, the supports were being made available for the women, and he had quite an emotional moment at the press event. The women who were affected found his intervention quite cynical. Like Emma McNahuna, Vicky Phelan, both spoke to Sunday newspapers that weekend, saying that they found him to be, I think the word Vicky Phelan used was he cried crocodile tears and stuff. So it's all well and good to have that very standoffish, you know, and distant relationship with the media, which is, you know, understandable to a certain extent. But also that has repercussions then for how everybody outside our little bubble treats, you know, sees you and shapes their perception of you.
Because really, most people don't care whether or not you guys get to do a doorstep with the Taoiseach two or three times a week. And he can, you get excited. And it helps to kind of fill the bottom of page five if he says something halfway interesting.
Feed a couple of paragraphs into a story.
But I do think he's not that, I mean, having seen him in, you know, in groups, he's not great. He's probably better in a one-on-one situation.
He's not the most...
He's socially maladroit.
He's not the easiest mixer among people. He's not the end of Kenny, go in, thump your arm, slap your shoulder type guy.
And he can put his foot in it a bit, as he did, for example, at that dinner in Washington. You know,
But, like, you know, the people around him would say, look, he knows his faults, he's learning from that, and that when he goes on these events now, he'll often have someone with him. So if he's at something, he will have Simon Harris by his side, he'll have Pascal Donoghue by his side, he'll have Owen Murphy by his side. So there'll be a crutch there to kind of work his way around with. But I think the pulling back is quite deliberate, and it is this about the office. And one of his people close to him said to me, I had to do a piece on his year anniversary a couple of weeks ago, said, you know, he sees himself more as a kind of a, not as a president, like he sees his engagement with the public more along the lines of what Mary McAleese or Michael D. Higgins would do. That type
does
of thing.
Does that go down well in the Irish political landscape?
No, Sarah? Because, I mean, look, I think we do need to mature, our politics do need to mature as our society matures, you know, and that was seen obviously with the recent referendum result. But I don't think in the Irish political landscape, I don't think there's anything better than meeting people, speaking to people. And I think that's where sometimes he falls down, because he is quite a shy individual.
To be fair to him, he meets a lot of people. Like like even the people I speak to in government who were pointing out his shortcomings quite bluntly to me said, but he does work hard.
Oh, no,
and he is on the road a lot. It's just he doesn't
no
talk
one is
to
doubt, yeah. No one's doubting that. But I think it's the level of your engagement with the people that you meet. You know what I mean? And I was at an event with him in Dublin Central. It feels like a lifetime ago now, but it was probably only a couple of months ago. And it was in the inner city. And I had attended those events previously with Enda Kenny, who made, you know, the troubles in the inner city and the crime in the inner city one of his key platforms as Taoiseach. And I suppose Leo just struggled in that situation, whereas Enda thrived. And it's not, you know, I think people knew, well, we knew what, you know, Leo Varadkar would be like as a Taoiseach. He's not Enda Kenny, but that it seems to be working for him. So,
yeah. Look, the economy is going well. It's a young government. You can't underestimate the feel-good factor around things. I think that's what the hope is, that, you know, that is the kind of wind behind the sail that will carry them into office. And as Sarah said, there is the blowback to this distance he is creating and putting his ministers out front, that I Sarah will disagree with me. I think that he didn't get enough credit for the referendum, and that Simon Harris got me. But that's what he did. He let other people take it on.
We had the most monumental decision one of the most monumental social decisions that this country was about to take, and Leo Varadkar adopted a hands-off approach to it until it became inevitable that this referendum was going to pass.
So you think he chickened out?
I don't know if he chickened out. He just was, you know, he just said it's a policy in which he adopts, where he allows his ministers to fight the fire, and then when it becomes a success, he takes all the credit. If you look back at the referendum campaign, had the a misfortune and perhaps pleasure of covering it from beginning to end, Leo Varadkar did about 5 or 6 interviews, all of which were in the last week, when it all became very clear that this referendum was only going in one way.
I disagree. I think what he did was...
What
that
did he do?
He engineered the entire situation. And he was...
How?
Because he had told people, numerous people had said to me over the last year, was annoyed at the time that he personally was in favour of 12 weeks from not just this Christmas, the Christmas before. And that he helped steer this situation.
I know you were. To Jesus now. Leo Varadkar could have had that personal opinion, and which he's absolutely entitled to have had for as long as he has had it or whatever. He did not have a role in bringing the Oireachtas Committee recommendations to the point that it was at. I am sorry.
I was told by newspaper that he was in favour of 12 weeks from a long way out. And the other thing is, he was the Taoiseach who decided to hold the referendum. And I think his entire approach to the referendum was strategic at times, because he knew that you can't, like, there's not, what use is it the Taoiseach debating with Pat or Tobin in prime time?
I'm sorry, then none. If you could have that argument about what's the use of Micheál Martin and Mary Lou MacDonald
because
debating
leaders of the opposition.
He's the leader of government.
That's the point.
Exactly, that is the point. And he took a completely hands-off approach to the referendum.
I totally disagree. I think he managed.
I don't think we're going to get a resolution here. Journalism is the first draft of history, and it'd be interesting to see what the historians make of that. Listen, on the referendum, I mean, you were up in Belfast. Sinn Féin had their special Ardesh, you know, arising from the referendum to change their policy in relation to the legislation on abortion, among other things. But that was the prime reason for the Ardesh. What kind of shape were they in?
Buoyant enough shape. You know, they're still on a high. I feel a bit sorry for the delegates. They've had to go to three Ardesh in the space of 6 months now. One for Gerry Adams' retirement, one for Mary Lou MacDonald's election, and this one. Which
they do seem to enjoy them.
They do, but even they have their limits. Like, the Waterfront Hall holds about 2,000 people. It was nowhere near full for the leader's address. It's quite a strange venue. It's a bit like the convention centre in Dublin. It's kind of a bit all over the shop. But they're in good form. You know, Mary Lou MacDonald has really got off to a flying start. And they kind of seem to really be confident in the image they're projecting of a party led by two women. You know, the purple suffragette colours were out in force. They played Sisters Are Doing It For Themselves after her speech. They seem to be kind of really amplifying that up a bit. On the
abortion, they're obviously not concerned by these claims that the DUP are being swamped by Republicans and Catholics.
I don't think so.
Looking to join them and vote for them.
I don't think so.
Carol
Nolan's resignation was expected. But I sat through the debate on Saturday and I just kind of thought to myself that it would be hard for Pat or Tobin to, you'd have to think long and hard about staying in this now, because the tone of the debate was almost like a rout. It was almost like, you know, this is a line in the sand. No more of this free vote stuff. The party is the party. There were delegates saying that they were pro-choice for decades and decades, and they had to stand on platforms defending the party's position when it was strongly anti-abortion. And, you know, we were trying to get in touch with Pat or Tobin. He's asked for a few days to reflect on matters. So I just kind of thought, as I was sitting in the hall, I was like, I wonder, will it be a wrench for him to stay in? So much so that delegates from his coming and me got up and said, look, this is really, really tough. Please, we're going to lose members over this. The atmosphere, I thought, wasn't very conducive to him staying in the party. And there's an appetite to just get rid of him. Like, I was people privately say, look, we've had this problem so many times. If he wants to keep pushing this, then just go. This isn't the place for him.
It's difficult for Sinn Féin to get rid of him, though. I mean, in a way, with the all due respect to Carol Nolan, she's a first-time TD. That constituency is to be merged.
She's probably going to lose her seat.
She's probably going to lose her seat. Patter is a vote-getter for Sinn Féin. In reality, if they're seeking to build the party in the next Dáil and Seanad, he is a guaranteed seat. If he was to stand aside and become an independent, it'd be very difficult for the party.
But what Fiach's kind of saying, it sounds to me, that, and looking at reports over the last day or two, it looks like Sinn Féin, the party, would be willing probably do some slightly tougher version of what it did at the time of the Protection of Life During Pregnancy Bill, with Pat or Tobin, i.e. some form of suspension for a 6 month or 12 month period.
Yeah.
But Pat or Tobin might actually feel that he can't remain within the party himself.
He's obviously thinking about it. The atmosphere in that hall was just so, you kind of put yourself in his shoes and go, if this was me, what would I be thinking? That's 4 times now he's put motions forward asking for a freedom of conscience. 4 times they've been rejected. And the message from the delegates loud and clear was, we do not want to have to do this again. Do not try and push us. So the party is not just the leadership. The entire organisation has kind of turned against
it. How does this feed at all into, obviously there's conscious votes permitted in the other two large parties, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. How does it fit into the narrative that Sinn Féin is still only a partly democratic party? That you know, unanimity is required once some central core of the party has made a decision. Does that play into that, or is this a new kind of a internal party debate?
Well, they always had these debates. Like any Ardesh you go to, they have debates, but it's always the case that the leadership motion holds sway. What the leadership wants, the leadership gets. You very rarely see the Sinn Féin grassroots standing up and sending something back to Gerard Carlo going, no, thanks very much. But, you know, there is a debate, but once the ranks are closed, the ranks are closed. That's it. And they pull back into themselves. And
I mean, it's hardly a surprise that Sinn Féin enforce the whip on their party members and that people who fall outside the whip get the consequences.
But even
of
even apart saying that, like, you know, a lot of the other parties would love to be able to enforce a whip like that. Like Micheál Martin tried to enforce the whip.
Even apart from those two individual TDs you've mentioned, I mean, presumably, you know, Sinn Féin has substantial support in rural areas in which there was a substantial no vote in places like Donegal.
Yeah, I think
is that not an issue at all for them?
Well, I think the biggest issue for them is the north of Ireland, where the level of support for what was adopted at the Sinn Féin Ardash at the weekend just isn't there, quite frankly. And I wasn't at the Ardash, so I should say this, but from what Fiac has told me and other political correspondents who were there, they got the distinct impression that the Belfast Brigade weren't necessarily there in full flow at the weekend, and perhaps, you know, they were more enthusiastic about Gerry Adams as leader than they are about
Adams.
Mary
was very low
Lou
key
as leader.
Very low key.
There is a shift. There's a power shift to the south has happened, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But even if you look at the speech on Saturday night, and again, I wasn't there, so I'm just looking at it from the TV. The audience seemed to be mostly kind of young, middle class, which absolutely plays to Sinn Féin's objectives and ambitions in the south. Does it play to their objectives and ambitions and their supporters and their core base in the north? That's the difficulty for them. So while they are an all-Ireland party, that partition between the north and the south exists.
What do you think? Because you were in the hall.
You were struck by the high number of young people, not just for leader's speech, but participating in debates and, you know, contributing to motions. But I suppose they're secure in the north. They've nothing really to worry about up there. They kind of have successfully seen off the SDLP. So it's natural that the focus would shift south and grow south and their objective of getting into government in the south. You know, I think they're in decent enough shape, but nobody wants to talk to them, so they're in a bit of a bind.
Finally, I just briefly want to ask you one thing. There's a, to my mind, hilarious photograph in today's Irish Times in the business pages. It's of Pascal Donoghue striding purposefully into a room to deliver his summer statement. It's one of those real all the lads photographs. You figure in it quite prominently there, Fiac, many other political correspondents. And I was particularly minded to bring it up because there's been a minor spat this morning about the McGill Summer School, something that tends to get extensive coverage in the Irish Times' pages every summer, and the absence of women in political discourse. I was out at an event, the Talkie Book Festival, and we were discussing what was essentially a post-referendum discussion. And quite rightly, somebody from the audience pointed out something of which I was highly conscious myself, that it was myself, three other men, and one woman, Dervla MacDonald of The Independent. And we see this problem in this podcast. We are conscious of it. We try to make efforts to redress it, but we fail a lot of the time. How much of that is down to my fault or the producer's fault or the difficulties that we have in actually achieving something that might reflect the actual people who live in this country?
Look, I think for me, I always have this difficulty where sometimes I get phone calls from broadcast outlets and they say, you know, we need a female on the panel, so can you come on? And I have this notion, this concept that I shouldn't be asked to be on just because I have certain bodily parts. You know, I would rather be brought on because I have an expertise in the area in which they're going to be discussing or whatever. There just seemed to be a level of consciousness that's on broadcasters' shoulders in particular with regards to panel discussions and so forth. I think the difficulty, though, is that, you know, the calibre of females willing to speak about the referendum on the Eighth Amendment. I mean, the fact that she had one woman on a panel to talk about a referendum.
No, it wasn't
which
that she
was
had debated
driven
about the referendum. Okay, it was a debate about the whole political landscape in Ireland. But given the time, you know, given what has happened, the referendum was the prime subject. You know?
Well, yeah, I mean, given that is the most monumental social decision that this country has taken, and probably the biggest political issue that has dominated the political agenda for the last year and a half. You know, there are plenty of female political correspondents. There are plenty of female politicians who played active roles in the referendum campaign. It just doesn't stand up to scrutiny. Like, I think, you know, to be fair, look, if you asked me to go to the summer economic statement yesterday and cover the press conference, my eyes would have glazed over as yours did at the beginning of this. It's not my cup of tea. Fiac loves the economics of it, so we leave him at it. But I don't think, you know, you can be critical of a photograph like that. But And it's actually not reflective of political correspondence in Leinster House.
It's not reflective of the gallery
look. Is it not?
No.
What is this specifically? I mean, you're a senior figure in the gallery these days.
It's about 50-50 or 60-40, I'd say. Like, there was a very striking picture taken for International Women's Day of all the... Not all of them were present. Taken of all the female journalists who work out of Leinster House, and it was a compare and contrast to a picture taken even, I think, 12 years ago, and the difference was amazing. Like, there was only a handful of women reporting from the Dáil at that size. The rest were very kind of middle-aged men and down, and now there was a lot more women. There is, like, that's... Be fair, that is that picture, although it looked like I'm running that far.
I'll stick it up on Twitter after the podcast.
So it's saying, there we are, all the lads. Like, but that's not representative of the press gallery.
No, I don't think it's representative, but I think sometimes photographs and perhaps panel discussions are crude barometers to the level of, you know,
They do reflect some realities, though, about, I mean, I think the organiser of McGill, Joe Mulholland, was saying something along the lines of, we couldn't get women in with the required levels of expertise to contribute on some of the subjects. Which
Joe, I never got a call from you, and I'm pretty sure that I'd be more than willing and able to discuss whatever political discussion you're going to have up in McGill Summer School, but I never got the call. So, you know, I'll pass you on my number, perhaps, and maybe you can think about it at a future occasion. Look, the people who are up there are perfectly entitled to be up there. Like, Fintan O'Toole is going to be up there. Stephen Collins is going to be up there representing the Irish Times. You know,
in full agreement with each other, I should say.
As always. I miss those old Fintan Stephen spats we used to have in here.
But if you know, there are plenty of other women commentators. Like, if you look at perhaps, you know, Stephen's role as a columnist, as a former political editor of this paper, and a good friend of mine, I have nothing but kind words to say about that man. But if you look at his role, you know, Justine McCarthy from the Sunday Times, perhaps. Sarah McInerney, former Sunday Times political correspondent, presenter on TV3 and RTE. There's you know, I'm only naming one or two. Ursula Halligan, Miriam Lord, anybody. We could go on and on.
Absolutely. We'd all love to see the Miriam Lord behind a microphone. That's a work in progress. Listen, we do have to leave it there. We've probably run over, but that was very entertaining and insightful from both of you. Thanks very much to Fiacc and Sarah for joining us today.
And that's it for this edition of Inside Politics. Thanks very much to our producer, Jennifer Ryan, and engineer, JJ Vernon. Remember that you can subscribe to us on iTunes or your preferred podcast provider. You can also find us at irishtimes.com/podcast. And your views are always very welcome. You can mail me, or you can always find me on Twitter, although maybe not for the next couple of weeks because I'll be off on holidays. Then my seat will be held by Pat Leahy very capably, I'm sure. Hopefully it'll still be here when I get back. But until then, goodbye, and thanks very much indeed for listening.